the tube rules all. I mean, nobody in his right mind could imagine that Ronald Reagan could be elected to the presidency of this country in 1940. And of course, it's true. You can say, well, it doesn't make any difference. We don't live in 1940, and that is true. But a movie actor without very great intelligence, with an extraordinarily fading bad memory, with an inability to understand even the most primitive political or economic ideas, nonetheless came across as a man who could have been elected forever. He could have beaten Bush. He could be reelected from the grave.
With the right TV ads.
With the right TV ads. On the other hand, Giuliani is mounting an Ailes campaign,
right,
which is a filthy campaign. It's a campaign that resurrects every tiny sin. And gentlemen and ladies, don't mention them. But a guy like Ailes exploits them. And Ailes exploited them for Nixon. He's in the business. He makes a tremendous amount of money. He has a whole group of people. And he's a professional in character assassination.
America's greatest award-winning documentary producer, Emile D'Antonio, joins us to discuss the media and politics and all of the dirty tricks and who does them and to whom right now on Alternative Views.
Radical filmmaker Emile D'Antonio has been studying the media and politics in American society for several decades now. His first film, Point of Order, was on the McCarthy Army hearings and studied how television processed this historical event and brought down Joe McCarthy, the great tyrant of the 1950s. D'Antonio also made a film, Milhouse, that focuses on Richard Nixon and the media as one of the themes of this movie. Since then, he's been reflecting on the role of the media in the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, and the general political functions that the media have taken over in American society in the last several decades. So, Dee, we're very happy to have you with us on Alternative Views, and we want to talk about politics and the media with you.
But before we talk to Emile D'Antonio, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
One of the most striking cases that has recently come into the news concerning the Reagan administration's traffic with drug dealers concerns American John Hull, who's a 69-year-old rancher in Costa Rica. Hull, from October of 1984 to September of 1985, received $10,000 a month from Oliver North for so-called humanitarian aid to the Contras. It was alleged that Hull's ranch in Costa Rica and his six landing strips were used as a Contra supply operation that were also the source of a drug operation that was used to supply and refinance Contra operations. We've reported this on Alternative Views, and this was widely discussed in the Alternative Press. Senator John Kerry, for instance, in his investigations in Congress into the connection between the Contras and big drug lords came up with five witnesses who said they saw Hull actually involved in the cocaine business. They saw cocaine being delivered from Colombia on his ranch.
They saw cocaine being loaded on planes back to the U.S., and a couple of the pilots who drove, who flew the cocaine back to the U.S. even testified against Hall. Well, this last January the 13th, the Costa Rican government arrested Hall, charged him with drug trafficking and violating neutrality laws that prohibited supplying arms to the Contras. So Hull was in jail in Costa Rica and was about to go on trial for his alleged efforts in Contra drug running and gun running. Well, at that time, Lee Hamilton, who was the head of the Iran-Contra Select Committee, wrote a very threatening letter to President Arias of Costa Rica saying that, and I quote, "It is our hope that Mr. Hull's case can be concluded promptly and that it be handled in a manner that will not complicate U.S.-Costa Rican relations. We thus want to avoid situations or incidents that could adversely affect our relations at this time." President Arias responded quickly and strongly to this attempt to try to blackmail him to drop the drug charges against Hall. Arias replied, "I deeply regret your letter. Mr. John Hall is accused of serious crimes, including participating in the illegal trafficking of drugs to the United States. It pains me that you insinuate that the exemplary relationships between Costa Rica and the United States could deteriorate because our legal system is fighting against drug trafficking, no matter how powerful the people who might participate in it or what external backing they might have." Well, Hull was held in prison in Costa Rica until March, at which time the Costa Rican government let him out on humanitarian reasons because of a heart condition. On July of this year, just before he was scheduled to go to trial, Hull jumped bail and returned to the United States, showing up in Miami and more recently on his family farm in Indiana. 2 days after he fled, a drug commission of the Costa Rican government released a report detailing both Hull's support for the Contras Southern Front illegal arms operations there and allegations that he was one link in what has become known as the Contra cocaine connection. The special Costa Rican commission concluded the amount of and frequency with which drugs moved through Costa Rica were the factors that motivated this commission to study the Contra supply network. The private network that supported the Nicaragua resistance, the Contras, used a number of people, both public and private, in order to achieve its goals. In Costa Rica's case, the network chose Mr. John Hall and several experienced Costa Rican pilots. The facts detailed here show that narco traffickers had infiltrated different levels of the network and operated and offered military support to the Contra. So that's the final report of the Costa Rican government that has a warrant out for Hull, declaring him to be a fugitive from justice and asking him that he be extradited from the United States to Costa Rica. So if the United States was serious about fighting drugs, they would send John Hall back to Costa Rica. So far, there's no indication that they will. And this story has been completely blacked out of the media in the United States. I haven't seen anything on it. Senator Kerry has announced, though, that he wants to bring John Hall to Congress to try to do some more investigation about the extent of Contra cocaine connections.
Doug, there are some more congressional investigations along with the U.S. Customs Service into airport in Mena, Arkansas. Now, how many of us have been to Mena, Arkansas, even though where it is? Well, it seems to be a very important place in the drug business. Barry Seal, the former Green Beret and reputed CIA man, who boasted of making $1.5 million in personal profits in just one cocaine flight alone. Well, he turned up dead, you know, as we told you about before. Well, it seems that he might have been involved in Mena, Arkansas. There's a little airport there that's known as one of the fastest, most economical stopovers in the Western Hemisphere for aircraft rehabilitation, painting, repair, and modification, all services that are highly valued in the drug world. This is an article from Freedom Magazine, by the way. Well, the reason the local people, the local prosecuting attorney, and local media people have been nosing around to find out what's been going on out at this place, out at this airport. But every time they try to come up with some investigations, they're either hushed or it's squelched. They even had a grand jury which was looking into it. But the grand jury just did a whitewash. The people who were called in, they weren't asked the right questions. They hemmed and hawed around, and they came up, well, they couldn't find any information. But, of course, they could have if they wanted to. According to Arkansas law enforcement officials that were interviewed by the Freedom Magazine reporters, all of these things that go on, or a lot of these things that go on in this airport, are indications of running drugs and guns. For instance, you can, there have been indications that tail numbers have been altered so that the plane couldn't, nobody could keep track of it. According to an Arkansas official, he said there was plenty of evidence that illegal money laundering was going on, but no indictments came down from that either, any of these investigations. It gets even murkier in that one Arkansas official stated that he had been questioned by federal investigators who came to MENA to locate some $48 million in unaccounted funds. The investigators reportedly said that the money came from drug deals connected with Richard Secord and Oliver North and their highly acclaimed enterprise. You remember, we was talking about that. The investigators were seeking to find the money in one of MENA, Arkansas's banks. Well, the police have been stonewalled, the local police there, and their efforts to find out. They've been stonewalled by the Justice Department, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service. When the heat is on, the suspects fall back on the line that they work for Barry Seal. And they say they work for the CIA. And once you say you work for the CIA, well, everybody has to drop it because it's national security.
Frank, there's several new books on the whole history of the drug trade that was published in these times that I want to give a brief report on to present some historical context for the whole political economy of the drug trade. One interesting document is a yearly State Department report on which countries are actually producing the drugs and how much they're producing and where the drugs are going. The State Department for the last several years has been doing this report on the grounds that any country that is actively involved in the drug trade is supposed to not get U.S. aid. However, this is hypocritical according to an analysis of In These Times, because last year the only drug producing country that was denied aid by the United States government because of this State Department report was Afghanistan. And according to In These Times, this prohibition of aid to Afghanistan omits the fact that 87% of the drugs that are actually produced in Afghanistan are not produced by anyone that has anything to do with the government of that country, but rather has to do with the rebels that are supported by the United States and the CIA. They quote one rebel leader who says, "We must grow and sell opium to fight our holy war against the Russian non-believers." According to this In These Times report, Afghanistan is now, the rebels in Afghanistan are now one of the biggest producers of opium in the entire world, and that their production has doubled in the last few years since the Reagan and the Bush administrations were supporting the Afghan rebels there that were fighting to overthrow the communist government.
I can't remember where I saw it, but a year or so ago, somebody was interviewing a kind of a mid or low level mafia drug type, and they asked him if he was afraid of getting busted for drugs because he was dealing drugs pretty good, making good living out of it, and because there were so many others who were being busted at the time. He said, "No, I'm not worried about that." He said the drug operations in the world now are controlled mainly by the CIA and Interpol, the International Police Organization. So, so long as you cooperate with them, you're all right. But if you start freelancing, if you start being a private enterpriser in the drug business,
and get away from their control and hegemony, well, then that's when you got busted. So he really wasn't. He was going to stay close, snuggle up close to the CIA and Interpol. Well, there's an article in Freedom for May and June edition, which chronicles some of this, talks about it. And the National Commission on Law Enforcement and Social Justice has asked the House of Representatives to look into Interpol's connection with drugs, particularly in their relationships with Noriega. As lo and behold, the Interpol Secretary General Raymond Kendall in 1987 gave Manuel Noriega a scroll thanking him for his role in helping to prevent international drug smuggling and combating drug trafficking. Wasn't that nice of them? So, but it goes even further than this. It's much more sinister. There's Lieutenant Colonel Nivaldo Madrinan in Panama, who in he's been the Interpol executive top man down there since 1983. People in Panama say that he was responsible for the murder of a well-known civic leader, Serafin Mitrotti, in 1983, just after Senor Mitrotti had come out strongly against drugs and had begun a major anti-drug campaign. Mrs. Mitrotti even said that this Madrinan, the Interpol guy, wound up wearing the $20,000 ring that her husband, her deceased husband, had. So he must have been involved very closely with the killing. There are other sources, too, down there indicating how closely this Madrinan, the Interpol guy, has been with the Panamanian Defense Forces, Noriega, and drug running. The organization, the National Commission for Law Enforcement and Social Justice, went further and started talking about the origins of Interpol. We've talked about this a few times before in Alternative Views about the Nazi, the starting up of Interpol using ex-Nazis. Well, they indicated the same thing. Their investigation showed that Interpol's president from 1968 to 1972 was Paul Diekhoff. He was a former Nazi SS officer. They quoted in this story an Australian member of parliament who said that the list of presidents and executive members of the board of Interpol read like a Nazi's who's who, during as well as after the war. But if you place, he said, what do you expect? If you place a Nazi in charge of a fascist organization like Interpol, the result is a crossbreed that can really do horrible things. And a West German police union spokesperson said that through Interpol, the drug lords in South America and Southeast Asia have access to information in Interpol's files, so they know what's going on all the time. So this is the reason why the NCLE is trying to get an investigation by Congress to do this.
We'll have more news after we speak with our special guest, Emil D'Antonio, America's foremost producer of documentaries, such as Rush to Judgment, Milhouse, a white comedy, You're the Pig, Point of Order, and Mr. Hoover and I. We'll be discussing mainly the mass media and their relation with politics, and particularly the dirty tricks.
Dee, let's begin by talking about the role of television in politics. In your movie on Richard Nixon, Milhouse, you had some interviews with Joe McGinnis, who wrote a book on the selling of the president that was a bestseller, I think, 1969, that studied the role of the media in the 1968 election. What did you learn from these interviews with McGinnis and your study of Nixon and the media?
Well, I think the first thing that I learned personally was that Nixon studied media and practiced and rehearsed television in a way that no other major candidate had done before. We thought that Jack Kennedy had done that, but Jack Kennedy knew he was good on TV. He was what Marshall McLuhan called cool, unruffled, fair, whereas Nixon always exhibited sometimes anger. And I mean, if you take the Checker speech, which is really long before television, made in 1952, you see that he pulls out all the stops like an old-fashioned movie, including tears and rage. He learned to get rid of all of that, and this is one of the reasons I put much of the Checkers speech into my film Millhouse, so that the viewer could see Nixon at one age and Nixon then. None of it came naturally to him, so that he had to study very hard how to use television. He was never any good at it. I mean, just as in sports, no one is ever as good as a natural. So is with TV or in politics, no one is ever as good as a natural. Nixon studied hard, but the study always showed, the lamp of study was always clearly there. And
he's also always so contrived. And
very contrived, yeah. And he was never any good at a really open press conference. Reagan, well, that's another story, but Nixon used television, however, very intelligently by creating theater and faking it. We were talking earlier about an event that I find almost the most revealing, the single show he did, because he traveled all over the country in the 68 election. He would get six moderately well-known people in any given, the one I filmed was in Philadelphia. It included a doctor, a lawyer, a woman of some kind, to show that maybe two women of some kind, that's right, there were two women, four men, and there would be a Catholic, a Jew, a Protestant, and you were supposed to recognize this by their faces, of course, which shows that you're totally without any bigotry. But all these people were prepared, and they were all Republicans, and they were all pro-Nixon. So Nixon, first he had Bud Wilkinson, the coach of the Oklahoma football team, say, "Now we're going to introduce tonight the presidential candidate, Richard Milhouse Nixon, and this is a totally unrehearsed program. These people are going to ask any question they want." And so the people would then say, "Mr. Nixon, what is your view on Vietnam? There's a totally unrehearsed question." And so Nixon came in with this prepared answer, and he was terrific, and terrific for Nixon anyway, given his limitations. And this happened. But the one I have, a really wise guy, a wonderful man, who was a friend of Joe McGinnis's, who wrote the book The Selling of the President about Nixon, they somehow or other planted this wild Irishman in there who was totally unprepared. I mean, he was totally, he hadn't been exposed to any of this. And he looked at Nixon, he looked him right in the eye and said, "Mr. Nixon, what is your opinion of this?" And the subject he named was something Nixon wasn't prepared for. And Nixon absolutely lost his cool and made up some kind of crazy answer. And it was very, very revealing. Nixon tended to blow anything that was extemporaneous, in which he spoke off the cuff, as we're, in a sense, are speaking. I mean, he once said to a question, if I retire from the White House, I'd like to go to some place like Oxford and write two or three books a year. I mean, any man who wrote a book knows you can't write two or three books a year unless you're writing trashy, sexy novels or something. But he was talking about serious political stuff. He tended always to blow it unless he was very well prepared. The film attempts to reveal the nature of the preparation, how much there was. It shows how to be elected president. It's the first film ever done about a president in office, and also about how that president got there. And the tube rules all. I mean, nobody in his right mind could imagine that Ronald Reagan could be elected to the presidency of this country in 1940. And of course, it's true. You can say, well, it doesn't make any difference. We don't live in 1940, and that is true. But a movie actor without very great intelligence, with an extraordinarily fading bad memory, with an inability to understand even the most primitive political or economic ideas, nonetheless came across as a man who could have been elected forever. He could have beaten Bush. He could be reelected from the grave.
With the right TV ads.
With the right TV ads, made when he was alive.
Right.
But he was remarkable. I mean, it's the most devastating commentary against this country that I know. is that a man who was so totally unfit to be president was elected president, and overwhelmingly so.
Isn't this also, the flip side of this is the opposition. The opposition was so inept in not pointing out any of his deficiencies. Can you imagine what, say, if Harry Truman would have run against Nixon, I mean, Reagan?
You know, I want to get back to the CIA, because we all know this, but it's a very important little item. Jimmy Carter was convinced he would destroy Reagan, because he had his famous briefing book. Mm-hmm. And in that book, he had the list of every possible issue that could be discussed in a debate. And Carter had a good memory. And he had all the points that should be made. And then someone stole the briefing book and gave it to Reagan. And Carter went bananas, of course, because this was only a few days before their debate. The briefing book is gone. Now, we know who stole it. They were rogue, or maybe even active members of the CIA.
But who were under the direction of...
Under the direction...
The man who became the head
George
of the CIA.
Bush. Yes, and George
Bush. Well, William Casey.
William Casey.
Well, William Casey and George Bush.
Right. Matter of fact, that was part of that October surprise operation,
part of it,
in which they had a covert action against a sitting American president, and they had something like, 127, 137 operatives working inside the Carter administration to bring it down and to provide information to him.
There were a incredible. Tremendous number, that's right.
So
it began with the briefing book, and then it went into the October surprise. And between the two, as everybody knows, the single critical issue of that campaign was the hostages in Iran. And the story of the October surprise is that Casey, some people say Bush, I don't believe that, but that Casey and others went to Paris and met with the Iranians and made a deal. For some reason, Khomeini hated Carter. So a deal was made that the hostages would not be released, and therefore Reagan could campaign on that issue of the disgrace of America having hostages in Iran, and that the hostages would be released immediately after the election or inauguration of President of Reagan.
In return for arms.
In return for armaments, exactly. There we were, the country we hated most in all the world officially, Iran, who had held our hostages so cruelly for so long. And there was the great American patriot Ronald Reagan, President Reagan then, who of course with the CIA sent arms to Iran, and the hostages were returned to us, and Reagan looked like a hero.
Right after the inauguration.
Right after the inauguration.
And shortly thereafter, a Israeli plane flying over Turkey, loaded with American arms, en route to Iran, crashed. Indicating that something was up at that time.
And the major media didn't pick up on this, basically, either.
No.
Dee, there's a mediating link between Nixon, Reagan, and Bush, and this whole issue of politics and media, and that link is named Roger Ailes. In 1968, Ailes was the media manager for the Nixon campaign and was in charge in managing his campaign and his image. In the McGinnis book, there's a revealing quote from Ailes. Ailes says, "This is it. Elections are never going to be the same hereafter. Henceforth, only performers will be able to be politicians." In other words, you need actors to act out the role.
Ailes was also, from the beginning, par excellence, the dirty
right.
pool player.
Right.
And this is happening in the New York City election right now, where at the beginning, David Dinkins, the black candidate, was far in advance of Giuliani, the Republican candidate. Now, the Democrats have always been a little soft. I mean, one of Giuliani's weaknesses, which I would have exploited had I been a Democrat, is that he wears a huge toupee. Now, there's nothing wrong with being bald,
as all three of us can attest.
But there is something just a little peculiar,
really,
about the kind of headpiece he wears, and nobody mentions it. I mean, people who know something about New York a little more than the average newspaper reader don't say anything. They know it.
Mm. Who is Giuliani? What is at stake in this New York mayor's campaign?
He's a guy with a great presidential hunger. He would like to be the first Italian-American elected to the presidency. He does have a very good record as a United States attorney. And that's a flashy thing. You know, he did the mafia, he did a lot of other people, and he won most of his cases. If he were to become mayor of New York, which most people consider an ungovernable city,
yes.
And if he were to make it work in any way, if he could just reduce crime somewhat or drug somewhat, which I don't think he could do, but if he could, he would surely be a presidential candidate. Because nobody anywhere is doing anything about drugs, and nobody really is doing anything about crime. It keeps increasing because the nature of our society is so unjust. It's not something you can increase. If you have poor people living in a ghetto and they turn on the tube and they see ads for Mercedes and Cadillac and they see all these shows that are full of people who seem to have limitless money, it's not hard to figure out that they're going to be, you know, that there's a way to make a lot of money. There are 18-year-old guys in New York who make $4,000 a week selling crack, and that puts you into an area where the police aren't going to bother you anymore because you can pay them.
The alternative is either no job at all or a dead-end nothing job at minimum
or
wage.
Or deal drugs.
Who is Dinkins, by contrast? What tradition does he represent?
Dinkins' tradition is the New York machine, political machine, which is part of what makes him vulnerable. Mm. He was chair of the city council. He's a good politician. He's not a great speaker. He's a quiet man. He's a man who I think inspires confidence because he doesn't raise any ugly issues. He's a very gentle, quiet person. I mean, that's his public posture. And it was very effective because people were tired of all that other stuff. And then Giuliani was hopeless. Giuliani is mounting an Ailes campaign,
right,
which is a filthy campaign. It's a campaign that resurrects every tiny sin. I mean, the one thing about politics of any kind in democratic countries is that everybody has committed tiny sins. The reason I could never run for politics is I'm a drunk, I've been married 6 times, you know, I've got a lot of problems. But ordinary people, maybe one night they got drunk and drove, one night they had an affair with something. But everybody has these peccadilloes, and gentlemen and ladies don't mention them. But a guy like Ailes exploits them. And Ailes exploited them for Nixon. He's in the business. He makes a tremendous amount of money. He has a whole group of people. And he's a professional in character assassination.
He brought the Willie Horton ads to us in the Dukakis-Bush 1988 election, which were grotesquely racist. And this is a very relevant factor to this Dinkins campaign, since obviously Dinkins is a black politician running for mayor of New York, and the only way that Giuliani can win is to get all the whites to vote for him. So obviously racism is a subtle subtext, or not so subtle, of this campaign, and having Ailes in there to exploit racism to the maximum is a very frightening and appalling phenomenon.
And the New York Times and ABC, NBC, CBS do not cover this. So Ailes looks like just another guy doing a job.
But you know, there's something. Nixon, from the very start, got his political ascendancy from destroying people's
Absolutely.
Reputations as a red baiter. So what did Ailes contribute to Nixon?
TV
that he hadn't, was the TV slickness?
I would like to go back to your point, though, Frank, because I think it's very good, because people forget that Nixon was the McCarthyite before McCarthy.
Right.
Because in 1946, when he ran for the Congress, some bankers in California interviewed 6 young men to run for Congress. These were money people, power people. And they chose Nixon, A, because he appeared in his Navy uniform, and B, because he already had a law degree. So Nixon was chosen. He was running against an extraordinary man, actually, who had been elected 6 times, who was a liberal.
Jerry Voorhees.
Jerry Voorhees, who had a private fortune, who was your characteristic New Deal Democrat, privately rich, concern for the poor, concern for the blacks, etc. And Nixon was your, he was the quintessential liberal, and Nixon is your quintessential opportunist. So he began a campaign that was unlike any campaign that anybody has any record of. People would, in the middle of the night, phone you, say, do you know who Jerry Voorhees really is? And hang up. They didn't say he was a communist. It was, do you know who he really is? Bingo. Voorhees, elected 6 times, a man with his own money, plenty to run. He was wiped out. Nixon won a huge victory.
But and there was a lot of red baiting, though, in addition to that.
Well, that's what I call red baiting. I mean, you know, what he was implying was that Voorhees was a communist. And then he red baited him specifically because of his views on labor, et cetera. But he wasn't a radical. He was a rich American of progressive views. And he ended up being tagged as a communist, of course. Nixon completed that little job in 1950 with Helen Gehagen Douglas when he started calling her the Pink Lady, which was, as you know, a fairly well-known drink in those days. But he also accused her of being soft in the Korean War. He wiped her out. She was a beautiful woman in every sense. She was a great political figure as well as a movie star and an extraordinarily attractive and articulate woman. But there was no way you could go against Murray Chotiner, who worked for Nixon, and Nixon, because there was nothing in the gutter that was too low for Nixon. Nixon, on the other hand, is an extraordinary man because he never gives up. Here he is getting, pushing up 2 years, he'll be 80. And he's still writing books proving that he was a great president. I mean, he doesn't write the books, of course. He hires people to write the books. But they write the books under his direction proving that he was a great president. And this, you know, this is the one thing I admire about Nixon. The only thing I admire about him is he has a kind of stick-to-itiveness, a kind of lonely man's guts that I find admirable, frankly. I despise him as a politician, as a man, but except for that.
So Roger Ailes is really continuing the Nixon-Murray-Chotiner techniques of dirty pool, of dirty campaigning, but he's using television ads as his weapon, as the main way of slinging mud onto the opponent.
He's worked in every campaign since he worked for Nixon in 68. He's become very rich out of slinging mud.
Well, what are some of the techniques of his political ads? How does he manipulate and sling mud here?
It's not as much ads as leaking information. I mean, he has researchers. They go through every day of a man's life that they can find. And in the case of Dinkins, when you come out of an underprivileged environment, when it's harder to be elected to anything, including the lower offices that Dinkins had, there are obviously mistakes you've made along the way, as indeed Giuliani made, or I would make, or you would make, or George Bush would make. But Ailes simply goes down, develops them incompletely, and then gives them out in to press releases, so that some one journalist really goes all out with it, which gives the guy a lot of passion. Then the other papers pick it up, or the networks, whichever way he's going. And then ads are designed by Ailes' people that then fit into that whole thing.
I see. Saying, so it's part of a whole strategy.
It's a structure.
Right,
it's a structure. If it were just releasing dirt, it wouldn't be enough. Mm-hmm. It's a whole gestalt that involves the dirt, how to exploit the dirt, and how to remove your character, your own candidate, from such a grubby, dreary, you know, your character is Rudy Giuliani, the United States attorney who sent those people to jail, whereas this guy, Dinkins, etc. And Dinkins was so far ahead, and now he's falling in the polls. So Ailes works, and the only way Dinkins will win is if he attacks Ailes and says, Ailes, who is this wretched creature, is Giuliani's man, finally. He's got to do something fairly remarkable.
I mean, there is a connection here, linkage between Ailes and the most despicable right-wing politicians of our generation, because it was Ailes
who won, helped Nixon win in his bids for the presidency, that was Reagan's media man, and that helped Bush beat Dukakis, and is now helping not only Giuliani in New York, but this guy Coulter in New Jersey. Oh, so every time there's a controversial or a close election between a liberal Democrat and a right-wing Republican, Ailes is brought in to be the hitman. He's sort of the hired gun, the gunslinger.
Coulter is
who's
the worst.
Coulter, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's he?
He's an extreme right-winger, and Bush has gone in there to speak for him. He's so far behind Florio. This is for, and this is more important than a...
New Jersey.
This is for the governor, governorship of New Jersey. And Florio was always many, many points ahead. And now they're in with the smears on Florio. You know, if you have an Italian name, you obviously have mafia connections and all the rest of it. So Florio is actually a very decent candidate. I'm not a great admirer of most of the times of either party, but he's a fairly decent candidate. He was far ahead because people really liked him. And Coulter is a inept person, unfortunately, in public presence. He may be intelligent, I don't know. But his public presence is too angry and hostile. And but the fact that Bush came in and spoke for him and that now Ailes is doing his campaign changed everything. We don't know how that one's going to come out.
Why do you suppose did the Democrats during this last presidential election, if anybody was vulnerable, it was George Bush. You know, they had the October surprise information, George Bush.
They had his girlfriends.
Involved with, his girlfriends, his extramarital affairs. They had George Bush and all the drug operations that he was involved in. And the, not even to mention that, he doesn't seem to appear overly bright. But they would not attack him. And he seemed to be just absolutely impossibly invulnerable.
In point of order there, he's not at all unintelligent. He's just not a good public speaker. He doesn't express himself well. But he's not at all stupid. Really, he is not. And it's not because he did well at Yale and at Andover either. I mean, it's not any Ivy League prejudice I share because I went to Harvard. But it's simply that I don't think Bush is at all stupid. I think he's a very bad speaker and he loses. Audiences disturb him. He has to have a prepared speech.
He seems so shallow, but or is that part of the
I think you have to be shallow to be elected. I don't see on either party, I don't see anybody profound being elected. Well, I think if you're an intellectual, you have no chance of being elected dog catcher, frankly.
Stevenson proved that.
And Stephen wasn't so intellectual. Yeah. He was just intellectual compared to the others.
Right.
But, I mean, the question Frank posed, which is a very good one, which is why didn't the Democrats employ similar techniques where they wouldn't even have to lie or sling mud?
The
truth. Could just speak up about the record.
Well, in the case of Dukakis, I think there was something weird in that campaign to begin with. I mean, you and I discussed that this morning, and I think we agree that Dukakis knew what to do, and he didn't do it. And why did he not do it? I mean, you know, there was something funny about that campaign. I had the feeling as it was going on and after the election, you could smell that he wasn't going to win, that it wasn't in the cards for him to win. And you hate to say that anybody took a dive, Republican or Democrat or any party, but you had the feeling that he was either protecting his wife or himself or a child or something, that something was amiss somewhere, that he was blackmailable or... Because he was so far ahead, and in the first debate, he was so much better. In the second debate, he didn't seem to be... He was flaccid. He was so soft. He didn't seem like a man who could be elected, not just governor of Massachusetts, be elected anything. And
it went downhill.
And he went down. Why was that? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's in the general realm of magic, mystery. I mean,
on the other hand, there is another factor here, and that is during the entire 1980s, the Democratic opposition in Congress rolled over and played dead to Reagan and Reaganism on every single issue. Reagan got his tax cut, his economic program. He got everything through Congress that he wanted.
Contra aid.
The Democrat, I think there's a bankruptcy Democratic liberalism here in this country. They just don't have programs and convictions and courage to stand up to these right-wing thugs
and to call a spade a spade, whereas the Republicans have plenty of guts to go out and, you know, get in the gutter and fight like hell to win and put through
and
their programs.
And basically make it clear that the country belongs to the rich.
And that they have a program, they have an agenda, and by God, they're going to get it through. You get in our way and you're destroyed, as Jim Wright and Tony Coelho and other Democrats found out.
But that almost confirms what I was saying about Dukakis in a way. Because something happened to Dukakis along the way. He began with such a tremendous lead in the polls, and I don't mean just after the convention, but even for a while after.
Right.
And suddenly, he was almost a non-candidate. And why? I mean, something else did happen. All the issues that you've talked about are absolutely correct, but they could have been brought up with anybody that the Democrats nominated, or could have been brought up right after the convention, as well as at any time, as well as consistently through the whole campaign. But bingo, Dukakis led in the polls, and then he mysteriously stopped leading.
Here's where Roger Ailes comes in again, because at the very time Dukakis was doing nothing, Bush and Roger Ailes were running the most aggressive anti-Dukakis campaign in history. And at this point, Bush started slowly going up precisely at the time that Ailes was putting out his Willie Horton ads convicting Dukakis of being soft on crime, the Boston Harbor ads showing sludge and filth in Boston Harbor claiming Dukakis was soft on environmentalism, which was, you know, a blatant lie. I mean,
absolutely,
compared to Bush and
Reagan. Boston Harbor had sewage put in it from 1778.
Right. So anyway, every day the Republicans and Roger Ailes would get out there and punch the shit out of Dukakis, and Dukakis just did nothing.
But are you telling us then, in fact, that the only way you can win a major race is to play dirty pool?
Well, you have to fight hard to win an election, and that means, one, you have to have convictions and something to run on, and two, you have to have the will to mount a campaign and use TV ads that might involve hardball if your opponent is using it against you.
As you know, in your house today, I called up a black friend of mine who was in politics in New York and said, look, this is what you've got to do. And then you spoke, and I called her back again. And I think we both gave her some very good ideas, frankly.
And we'll share them with you. What we said was that the only way that Dinkins is going to be able to win in New York is to go on the offensive. If he lets Giuliani smear him and refuses to really fight hard to win, he's not going to. We also came to the conclusion that Roger Ailes should be an issue in this New York mayoral campaign, because Ailes has become the major force in American political life, the Darth Vader of American politics, with his dirty mudslinging campaigns has polluted and fouled American politics. And all the reporters know this. Anyone who's a political insider knows that Ailes is the worst of the media manipulation people that have ever lived. There was even an article on him on page 20 of the New York Times yesterday, Thursday, that indicated he was indeed running Giuliani's campaign and Coulter's campaign, and told of some of his strategies. So we were suggesting to Flo Kennedy, who works with the Dinkins campaign in New York, that Ailes should be made a issue, that ads should go on that sort of merge Giuliani and Ailes' image.
And Nixon.
And Nixon and Reagan and Bush.
Because New York City and New York State, New York State was the only state, one of the few states not carried by Reagan.
Right.
New York City was overwhelmingly against Reagan both times. And it's damned hard for a Republican to win in New York unless he has an issue like this.
Right.
And Ailes has given him that issue. If you attack Ailes, you attack the very heart of the Giuliani campaign.
That Dinkins is running not against Giuliani, but against Ailes.
And Dinkins is a very quiet gentleman. He's a gentleman, and he's a very quiet man.
Mm.
Whereas Giuliani is now stepping it up into high gear rhetoric.
Isn't there another problem which politicians face, particularly against the Republicans nowadays, and that is that during campaigns or debates, or there will be just a whole spate of lies, one right after another, and So then the opposition is faced with the fact, well, do I counter all of these lies? Because if I counter all these lies, my time is taken up, and I'm not able to present my own agenda. Plus the fact that if I counter these lies, they're going down the road spewing more lies.
So you got to take
absolute lies. So what do they? Yeah. So what do they
I
do to counter?
I think you simply say, I'd like you to know that my opponent is a liar. Now I will detail this in future ads of mine. I will supply the facts in newspaper ads in which they will be written carefully so you can read them and go from there. And I think it's time to say that Giuliani is a liar, and that the lie, Giuliani is a puppet liar who speaks the lies of his master, Roger Ailes. Giuliani was hopeless. He didn't bring Ailes in until, as you said, he was so far behind that he had to do something radical and drastic. So he brought in Ailes, and then they started on the personal thing. Anybody is liable to a personal attack. If you're, say, the average age of a candidate, even for mayor of New York today, is probably around 50. Dinkins being somewhat older, and Giuliani a little bit less. If you take somebody roughly 50 years old, I mean, what can't you find out about him, you know? Did he cheat in high school? Did he have a love affair in college that was a little steamy or messy? Did he get drunk one night and get stopped by the police? I mean, you know, everybody has one or two of those in his life. Mm. Well, a guy like Ailes can sniff them out.
Mm. But on the other hand, we have the situation with Dan Quayle, who was just all full of this type of stuff, and it didn't seem to hurt Bush.
Nobody pushed it hard. No one pushed it hard. If the New York Times and the Washington Post had gone after Quayle, I don't know if it would have affected the race anyway, but it would have had a much bigger meaning than it did. Nobody really went after Quayle.
This comes back to where we started, which is that of the media. They're the ones that can make or break any given politician. In the case of the Bush-Dukakis race in 1988, the media could have exposed Bush as easily as Dukakis. They could have undone him as they undid Gary Hart and Jim Wright and other liberal Democrats who came under their fire. The same thing in the campaign going on now with Giuliani and Dinkins.
But who owns the newspapers?
The media are the ones that are defining the issues, are taking the positions. Today, the big story in the New York Times was this financial disclosure on Dinkins. If the Times had not put this on the front page, it would not have been an issue. So they really define reality in a very important sense.
What was that story?
Just the story about Dinkins having a financial impropriety where he didn't put the full amount of some investment on an income tax statement. Oh. Just, you know, a little petty financial thing. But again, this is the sort of thing that Ailes likes to blow up. But the point is, Ailes couldn't get away with this unless the media went along with it. So really, we have the complicity of the mainstream media with this right-wing Republican. So you can't just blame it on, you know, sleazo politicians like Nixon and sleazo media people like Ailes. If the media didn't play ball with them, the media could expose them, in fact.
Well, the media should expose them.
Yeah.
But Dinkins can expose them if he has the guts. Mm-hmm. If he takes a full-page ad in the Times and he has the money to do it, he has a well-financed campaign. Mm-hmm. If he takes a half-page ad in the three major New York newspapers and sticks one on TV about Ailes and Giuliani, he's got a new ball game going. Mm. But it takes a kind of fighting spirit to do that I'm not entirely sure Dinkins has.
Mm. Well, what about his campaign manager?
Well, this is what we tried to do today. We called a woman lawyer, friend of mine, who is very much into the Dinkins campaign, and we're hoping that she'll push.
See, the media could push this if they made Ailes an issue. And it's interesting, they definitely made television advertising and even Ailes an issue in the 1988 presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. But the spin on it wasn't fatal to Ailes. They didn't present him in the most strongest negative terms. If anything, they promoted him as a genius, perhaps a slightly dark genius of political ads, of political machinations, which just gives him more money in his next campaign. So it all depends on the spin the media puts on a phenomenon like Ailes, whether they define him as a villain or just a hardball professional.
Well, you can say the same thing about any administration. Ailes only pops up during campaigns, but during the rest of the time, Media certainly didn't attack Reagan or expose his foolishness.
And you're right about Ailes, because it is like a cowboy movie. He's the hired gun who goes from place to place, and he does what you want. He prefers Republicans. He prefers extreme conservatives. But he's for hire, and his price is high as hell.
We'd like to thank Mr. D'Antonio for being with us on Alternative Views this time. Now for one last news story.
In Harper's Magazine, I had a little section with a correction which U.S. News and World Report had for a story in which they didn't quite get the everything just right. The story was about Vietnam's sad legacy, the Vietnam veterans who were having trouble adjusting and they were having to live out in the wild. Well, there was a Mr. Sizemore who didn't like the way U.S. News and World Report portrayed him, and U.S. News admitted, well, they said, contrary to the article, Mr. Sizemore did not flee to Alaska, is not hiding out in Alaska, and is capable of living with his fellow human beings, and did not go to Alaska because his biggest fear that was somebody was going to hurt someone. He was afraid he was going to hurt someone. Then they had a picture of Mr. Sizemore in the story, showing him standing in front of a neighbor's rustic cabin. They said, well, that's where he lives. But in matter of fact, he lives in a much more spacious dwelling. And they also, the U.S. News and World Report article, emphasized the primitive nature of where he lived, ignoring the fact that he has several amenities, including electricity and a microwave oven. And they said the story also mentions an incident which Mr. Sizemore complained about the personnel in the Veterans Administration, saying that it occurred in the 80s, but it really didn't. It actually occurred in the 60s. And then finally, contrary to the implications in the article, Mr. Sizemore did not serve in Vietnam and doesn't suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And the headline or the title of this article, which Harper gives this, is, well, at least we spelled your name right. That's good. Isn't that incredible journalism? But, you know, what the hell? You take a speech by George Bush or Ronald Reagan, and there are a lot more lies and distortions in any of those, but they never get corrected.
And that brings us to the end of this Alternative Views. We'd like to thank our camera person, Eric Eubank, our audio man, Kevin L. West, and our editor, Rob Widdowson. And as always, we want to thank Austin Community Television, ACTV. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You might be interested to know that we have expanded the distribution of our program quite a bit in the recent weeks. And now Alternative Views is seen in about 60 cable systems around the country, serving approximately 280 cities and suburbs and about 4.5 to 5 million households. But we thank you for watching Alternative Views. Make it a habit, please. Bye-bye.